Welcome to Law Subscribed. This is your dedicated news source for all things subscriptions and the law. My name is Matthew Kerbis. I'm the subscription attorney, and I believe subscriptions can help bridge the access to justice gap and incentivize attorneys to modernize and scale their practice like never before. In this episode, I interview Matthew Burgess. Matthew is disrupting the billable hour down under. He has a deep understanding of all the benefits of productizing your legal services and separating the value of time from money. He's experimented with subscriptions over the years and shares what worked and what hasn't in this interview. I'm releasing videos of my podcast to all my Substack subscribers. You can subscribe for free at www.lawsubscribe.com. Thank you to my sponsors, 650 and Gavel. Links to both in the show notes. More on them later. And remember to use the code LAWSUBSCRIBED when signing up. It lets them know you found out about them from the podcast. You get 10% off, and it really supports the show. Another way to support the show is to share it with someone you know. This podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only, and nothing said is legal, ethical, or financial advice. Without further delay, here's the episode. Matthew Burgess, another subscription attorney named Matthew, welcome to the podcast.
Matthew, thank you. Good to meet you properly.
Yes, and I always get it. So I got to ask you, do you tend to just go by Matthew or do you still go by Matt? I mean, when people ask you your preference, what do you tend to say?
I was going to ask you the same question. I certainly know that when I'm in trouble with my mum, it's always Matthew.
Yeah.
What about for you?
You know, because there's so many of us, I usually just say, because you asked, just call me Kerbis.
I love it.
I'll be a last name first, you know, and Burgess and Kerbis kind of sound similar.
So, there's a lawsuit somewhere there.
There might be. But if my guests haven't already figured out from your accent, because this is a U.S.-based podcast, essentially, though I've had many non-U.S.-based lawyers and technologists on the podcast, where are you calling in from?
We call our little place Bris Vegas as a hat tip to another part of the US. It's a place called Brisbane on the eastern seaboard of Australia. It's the capital of Queensland. So if you know where Sydney is and you drive, say, about 1,000 miles north of Sydney, you'd end up in Brisbane.
All right. Well, I discovered you through a Lawyer's Weekly article where you were quoted and, of course, come to find out that you've been a part of the Verisage Institute for quite some time. Now, that's, of course, my longtime listeners will know I had Ron Baker on, and then I appeared on the Soul of Enterprise podcast, but you were on that podcast the same year that I founded my law firm. So you've been doing this for a little while. So it's only, I think, because we're halfway around the world from each other that I didn't discover you sooner. But you have a lot of unique insights to share. So just, you know, how long have you been trying out this whole subscription thing with legal services?
Yeah, thank you, Matthew. And to the listeners that haven't listened to your show on the Soul of Enterprise, strongly endorse a really good session, inspiring session, actually, on a number of levels. So, yeah, well, I'm probably aging myself a little bit here. I normally would say I'm a recovering time-billing lawyer, introduce myself, Matthew Burgess, recovering time-billing lawyer. So I started out in the late 1990s at quite a strong, big law firm. It probably wasn't even big law back in the day, actually, but it grew to about, we had 60 or 70 partners in my time there. Started with less than 10 when I started. And my main specialization, frankly, was filling in timesheets. So I was clocking up regularly, sort of 2,500 to 3,000 chargeable hours a year, year on year, and managed to get through that system. Yeah, there's no video probably on your podcast, Matthew. Gervis has just gone, whoa. And all legitimate as well. I was basically working sort of 12 to 16 hours, 16 days a week. And then I'd always clock up a 10-hour day on a Sunday. It was sort of my lazy day. And yeah, and got through. So I got through the partnership before the age of 30, which is quite quick in Oz. And then was full equity partner before I was 35. So sort of was living the dream. And in preparing for today, because I thought you might say to me, well, what changed in all of that for you? And I think, looking back, and this was, you know, this is how old I am. There was no Google. There was no podcasts with people like thought leaders like you showing us where we needed to be going and leading the lights. But someone had given me a physical copy of a book called The Firm of the Future. I must have gotten that out. I got that in about 2004. I'm a slow learner because its basic thesis was, well, you've got to burn the timesheet. And that, given that my main goal in life is to fill in the timesheet, that was a little bit of a counterfactual that I couldn't fully digest. But I think I started down the journey probably about 2005, 2006 to start Black Sea. then sort of iterated away to then to fix fees. It was a real journey. It was over a period of time, but certainly by around 2008, 2009, it basically stopped any form of time billing. Still had the time record because it's part of the machine. And yeah, I can give you some more detail from sort of 2010 onwards if helpful, but that were the early days.
Still though, a pioneer by modern standards of attorneys not billing their time. And at the time of recording, you wouldn't have had a chance. I had another guest on the podcast, and he's something like 20 years not doing it, not billing time.
Wow.
But still, and that's called Timeless Counsel is the name of his firm.
Outstanding.
Right. And so, even with like that attorney's an anomaly, like you're in this category of, you know, I've had a number of guests on who for 10 years or more just found billing time was not the way. So obviously, you know, back then subscription legal services were, I mean, unheard of. They were unheard of 5 years ago, let alone, you know, 12, 13 years ago or longer. So what made you want to start using the subscription model, and where did you discover that that was even a possibility?
Awesome question. And it is interesting. I mean, it's why I think it's so inspiring to see you doing what you're doing, because there was no man. There wasn't even really a community. And the VeriSage community was certainly there, but it hadn't got to subscription either. So but by about 2010, we'd established, well, at least in Oz, was probably the first virtual law firm. So within that big organization, we set up a firm that had no timesheets. It was meant to have no physical office. It was meant to be a results-only work environment. So I've got a whole range of ideas that were effectively exact opposite to what a big law firm would do. That was spectacularly unsuccessful. And it was probably the beginning of the end for my journey inside that firm. So we left that in about 2014. We had about 6 or 7 months gardening leave. And sort of by the end of 2015, we'd set up our own organization, deliberately disruptive. And our key goal was to be the exact opposite to big law. So every single criteria that you could think of, whether it be timesheets, holiday leave, individual budgets, firm budgets, having an office, like every single thing that big law did, we just put a mirror up against it. And we did the exact opposite. And part of that, and I can't actually remember exactly what the catalyst was, it would have been a number of different things, but one of the questions that we asked ourselves during that process was, well, how could we deliver legal solutions for a dollar a week and be valuable, be exponentially more valuable than a dollar a week? And that was our very unsophisticated, we would have copied it off some other industry, but that was our very unsophisticated way to try to get into subscription. And if anything, it was probably our biggest failure, but also our biggest success, because it itself as product was useless, Matthew. Like it basically no one's bought it. The people who did buy it ended up probably extracting in some instances hundreds of dollars a week of value, because we had little things like in upper tiers of that package, we had unlimited access. Well, and we had no quarantine fence, ring fence around that unlimited access.
Right.
So it's like disastrously bad idea. But it also then gave us a link into a technology company that understood what subscription was. And we went on about a 3-year journey with them, which ultimately saw them sell into a listed company. But that really educated us. So from about 2016 to into 2019, beginning of 2020, we were just basically joined at the hip with this technology company that was entirely subscription based. And it really educated us at a time when, as you said, the legal industry just wasn't really there itself.
Yeah. And that was a client of your firm that they were paying you a subscription, or they were a technology company that was using the subscription model that inspired you to adapt the model?
Another awesome question. So that they had seen what we were doing, and they were all sort of, it's an interesting model. I don't know how relevant this is for the US audience. They were sort of like Legal Zoom, in so much as they were providing legal content, outlining legal documentation, layer in the trust and estate planning a little bit. So that they're throwing them on trusts, a lot of company incorporations. They needed the legal documents to sit underneath that. And they needed a law firm that understood that charging on time was not a winning strategy. So they needed someone to provide the legal smarts to allow them to sell that product out. Now the interesting nuance, I mean, there's a lot of nuances, but the two interesting nuances I'd say is compared to a LegalZoom is that they were 100% subscription in terms of their core business at that point. But then on top of that, their distribution, they had a lot better margins than I would understand LegalZoom had, because their distribution channel was out through a network of other professional advisors. So accountants, financial advisors, and to an extent other law firms. So they had a much stronger ability to charge a premium price, if you like, because they were offering that service into an intermediary that then on sold the product to the underlying customer.
Okay. I mean, it's a super interesting model. So what your firm was doing was you were providing the legal products that they were selling on subscription.
Correct. And that sounds simple, but if I give you an example, and I think this is all public information, because they ended up selling into a listed company, is that, so we had to build, if you like, the infrastructure. We had to build the smarts to allow our core legal documentation to be completely weaved into their technology platform to make all of that instantaneous. Mm-hmm. So if you were an end user accountant and you needed a trust and a company right now, we just log into the site. A lot of them would be pre-populated. It would then, you'd press a button and instantaneously all of the documentation would be generated. But then on top of that, a lot of the compliance issues, which again, I think would be relevant in the US, were automatically done as well. So that one central hub, it went off to the revenue authorities in Australia. It went off to banks. It went off to all of the other compliance things. So not only did you get your underlying legal document, but all your statutory registrations, for instance, instantaneously completed as well. And, you know, on a busy day for us, before that joint venture, you know, we might set up 5 companies on a really busy day. Well, within that platform, we could be setting up 5 companies a minute, but that they would be doing hundreds, if not thousands, of transactions a day. So it totally blew our mind that level of scale that's available.
Right. And I mean, that's the magic word, scale, right? Yeah. And when you're doing that, I mean, it's lawyers are smart people, right? Like for anyone, you know, I'm less familiar with outside the US, like legal education system, though I know that it's better in a lot of regards because there's like bachelors of law. So you don't have to, you know, go through undergrad and a graduate program to practice law in other jurisdictions.
Yes.
But like you just to go through that anywhere, like it takes a certain kind of mind. So I feel like, and this is why I have the podcast, like any lawyer exposed to what you just said in that situation can't not see the value of scale, which you can't do when you're billing your time, right?
Yeah. 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 It was scale on steroids, that's it. Like it totally rocked our world because, you know, there were some law firms that might be saying doing 20 companies a day and they'd be like, oh, you know, we're amazing and look at us. Then, you know, through this technology company, that could be doing just as easily 20 a minute. So, yeah. So the scale was just unbelievable. And I think, unfortunately, you know, one of the great qualities of the legal industry is the level of arrogance and ego. But I think that, again, is probably almost the greatest weakness as well, that they, you know, we're in the space we were working, people just had no comprehension of what a subscription-based technology-driven solution might be able to deliver.
Yeah, it's one of these things where I feel like if the bar associations or the licensing bodies, wherever they may be, banned under legal ethics the billable hour, which, you know, frankly, it might already be unethical, right? But putting that to the side about whether or not it's currently unethical, you know, if bar associations or licensing bodies said no, it's unethical, lawyers would have to adapt, and why wouldn't they do what you're talking about in that sort of circumstance? And you could be more profitable, like right now, like when it comes to like profit, like compared to what you saw when you were billing time versus effort going in versus what you experienced working with that company, you know, with what you were able to profit in terms of time and scale. Like, how did it even compare?
You've answered my question. There is no comparison. And I'll give you one example, which hurts a lot of lawyers. And I fall into this category as well in terms of our firm, is that, you know, how many lawyers really can sell their firm? At the end of their journey, how many of them can sell their firm? And if they can, what's the multiple they're getting on that? Well, you know, from what we've seen, and we've looked at roll-ups here, and there's some firms that are listed in Australia, some legal firms, you know, you might get 1x profit in terms of your multiple. Well, when this tech company sold to the listed company, again, public information, they were selling on a multiple of something like 20 on revenue. Yeah. Not even on profit.
Yeah.
Just like, seriously, it's not even your question, as you said, isn't your answer. It's not even a question. There is no divide.
We've on this podcast, we've just barely scratched the surface with some guests, and I've done so many interviews, I can't remember if those episodes are live or not yet. but it's another important point to drive home, because especially for attorneys listening to this, who maybe they're in big law, or maybe they're in law school, and they want to start a firm from scratch. Now, it's going to be easier if you're starting from scratch. You could still do it if you have an existing firm, but you got to think exit strategy, right? You got to build the firm from the ground up, and your firm, View Legal, that doesn't have a bunch of lawyer names in it. My firm, Subscription Attorney LLC, doesn't have a bunch of names. All right, we're building a brand. That's number one, right? And number two is the value of which you could sell it at. And I think one to two times, like gross revenue or net revenue or something, or gross profit. There's like different ways to measure it in the U.S. But yeah, law firms sell for one to one and a half of, depending on what you're measuring. But yeah, subscription revenue firms, businesses sell for 10, 20. I mean, in the tech industry, sometimes hundreds of times.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's still human stuff with law that you can take out a lot of that human stuff with tech, although that tends to be like customer service, is like where the human stuff comes in. But the more that we can adapt that, the better. And I think that LegalZoom model that you mentioned is a great model, right? And like with tools like one of my sponsors, Gavel, like that, there are other competitors. I like Gavel because I use them, and also they're a sponsor, but I used them before they were a sponsor. And And they help you turn your law firm into LegalZoom. And here's the thing, like there's tons of market opportunity out there. So it's not like we're all going to be competing with each other or with LegalZoom. At least in the US, they can't offer legal services, which is why they partner with law firms, of which I tried to do when I started my law firm, but they only do reduced billable hour rates, kind of like a legal shield type situation. So, they're not even like their LegalZoom isn't even set up to offer alternative fees to people who want to, customers who want to take it a step further and actually hire a lawyer right now. And I just want to let you know about this. I don't know what this is like in Australia, but prenups here in the US, usually to make it an enforceable document in court, a premarital agreement, each side needs legal representation. There's a company, Hello Prenup. I'm one of the lawyers on it for Illinois on that website. They sell a prenup product. That's a document. They're not a law firm, founded by a law firm. And so they're able to sell that flat fee. Now, what they do with the lawyers, it's kind of like LegalZoom has lawyers that they vetted first. What they do is they ask us to do just a flat fee, which I do. I'm already doing it, right? But I'm happy to do that flat fee. So they've taken the opposite approach to LegalZoom in terms of their lawyer panel, if you will. They don't call it that. But they're like, any lawyer that we're going to recommend must offer a reasonable flat fee, because the client, our customers are already price sensitive. That's why they're not going to a law firm billing time to draft these documents from scratch. So they're taking that approach with it. And I see, frankly, a huge opportunity there for law firms and subscription law firms, because what I've been able to do, I'm curious to get your perspective on this since you do subscription, is I've been able to represent those clients, and 100% of them I have converted to subscribers of my practice because I do a good job. They're already getting a deal, and now they know, you're not just my prenup lawyer. I could hire you for anything. What do you think about that?
Awesome, Chair. It is very similar in Oz. I think the two things that come to mind when you were talking was, firstly, and you may have heard me say this before, but the movement from time billing to fixed price changed my business model, absolutely. Like, it fundamentally changed my business model. Moving from fixed price to offering tiering and then getting into subscription, it frankly changed my life. And it was just that radical a change, those two points in time. The one question that I've got back for you, and I have not got through every one of your podcasts, so I apologize if it's one that you've explored in detail before, but the one question I've got back to you, listening to you, is probably the biggest lesson that we've learned and failed on is not understanding the nuance between a subscription model that has a finite ability to scale, as opposed to a subscription model that has an infinite ability to scale. And that, I think, is one of the biggest challenges for lawyers, certainly on the models that we've worked in that have ultimately the requirement for someone like you to do something. There's a true upper cap on that. And in many instances, we actually find, and I know this goes against, you know, a lot of the Ron Baker thinking and Paul Dunn, is that we actually find value pricing is probably still the appropriate pricing approach where you've only got a finite ability to scale in the subscription space.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it is a really interesting question, right? Because I think nothing is truly infinite in terms of the ability to scale, but perhaps it's so you could scale to such a large level, it may as well be infinite. So let's just get that assumption out there. I think that it also depends on the goal, right? Like I am a true solo. I just leverage technology. And eventually I'll be leveraging like fractional paralegals and VAs and stuff, right? Like I have no plans to hire or grow. I'd rather with this podcast inspire other solo attorneys that I could refer business back and forth between, right? And then let them have their own business. Then I don't have to worry about the management and the hiring and the firing and all that stuff and the benefits, right? So like my goal is not to scale infinitely personally. So I'm not necessarily trying to solve for that because my goal is sustainability. And how high can I, you know, what can my profit be just scaling to my cap of the true solo attorney? I suspect, at least in the U.S. in 2023, I may be able to get to $500,000 in gross revenue without having to hire and grow and scale in the traditional way if I fractionalize everything. And I think that's my upper limit, I suspect, based upon current trends and where technology is going. Now, that's even with generative AI, right? And I think that's an important part of the conversation, right? Because if you can make AI clones of you or your firm or what have you, your ability to scale goes up significantly without having to hire more. And if you're able to train those models on the conversations that you are also continuing to still have when you do have that synchronous or asynchronous communications with you and your clients, then those models improve. So, you know, but even then, like eventually there will be saturation in the blue ocean market opportunities, right? Like right now when Big Law zigs and you and I zag, there's huge market opportunity in the zag. But with this podcast, like eventually over time, those markets will become saturated too. But then I still think most lawyers will still be having extremely profitable businesses, right? So I don't know. I don't think it makes sense to scale to the infinite. I think you have to set a business goal and try to figure out what your upper limit is and then test yourself and see if you could surpass it. That would be sort of my, you know, my recommendation there. And I do think that automation and generative AI are like the keys to scaling closer and closer to that infinite as an individual or a small practice. What do you think, Matthew?
I think that's an awesome insight. I think, you know, the $500,000 in recurring revenue, that sounds impressive to me for a solopreneur. To give you a point of reference, when we were doing a biotech solution, LegalZoom style outcome, at the point of sale, to like for like in terms of legal involvement, it was close to $8 million a year recurring revenue and growing. And there was no need to add additional legal support into that. So that's, you know, I'm not saying either's wrong or right. It's a little bit like the old David Maister when he used to do this. You're probably too young, but he used to do this quadrant of how you can make money in the law. Talk about brain surgery and a GP and a pharmacist and a chemist. And it's not that any one of those four styles of legal discipline or legal specialization, I should say, are better than the other. It's just that they're radically different business models required, depending on which quadrant you're sitting in. And the risk for lawyers is that you assume you're sitting as a brain surgeon, but you're actually a chemist. And that's where people, you know, historically, where lawyers have fallen down. So my question more is, yeah, if you're going to stay a solopreneur and run for that, that's great. But if you are looking to go beyond the $500,000 in revenue to pick a number, what is it that allows you to do that? And if you're wanting to grow that, can you do it without adding in more legal support? Now, you've already answered it for your business because you're thinking you're so much further down the path than so many other people. But the question is for other people at the start of that journey, you know, where are they at?
Yeah, let's dive a little bit more in on your current model then. So, you know, I think we got up to like 2020 with you. So now let's talk about, you know, where are you at now? You know, what does your model look like now? You know, is there any other business that you can analogize, you know, outside of law, maybe to give our listeners a better perspective of what your business looks like now?
Great question. So we, having been inside the machine and then thought we were the disruptive player, when that sale took place at the start of, just before COVID actually, in 2020, we chose not to exit stage left and go back into the machine. So for us, that was a complete reset and we really had to stop and think again. Our subscription, and I'm happy to give you as much or as little detail as possible, but is probably, in terms of revenue, it would be less than 10% of our overall revenue now, whereas before it was materially more than that. And in terms of resources, it's probably more like a quarter of our investment, maybe more, and hopefully growing. The struggle that we've had is that we would like to scale and we would like to get up to decent numbers, but we acknowledge that to do that with human involvement, it's a dangerous game to play. And if anything, it's basically glorified joint billing. No, it's branded differently, but it's the only way you can scale. I think this goes to the heart of your model. The only way you can truly scale is by adding on more human capital. Then if you actually look at it, you're just on a retainer, even when if you call yourself subscription. And frankly, it goes to my point a moment ago, our decision has been that for that style of legal product, we're better to stick with value pricing and do that as explicitly as we possibly can.
Yeah, you know, I don't think that there's like, you know, one model to rule them all. If you'll, you know, take the Lord of the Rings reference there. I think that like hybrid models are okay, right? Like, and in the CLE that I do, you know, I do talk about pure subscriptions that, you know, that can work. And in the fractional general counsel world, they work extremely well if you figure out the right scoping, which I do in terms of projects. I've not been burned by that, you know, 10 projects a month. Or 15 projects a month, plus bundled in all these other services that I would normally unbundle and bill for separately. And I just bundle them all back together. Because at the end of the day, for the market I'm trying to serve, 10 to 15 projects a month for business clients is more than enough. And because I have per page pricing, even if they only send me 3 or 4 projects for a month, if I were to charge them per page, they would pay far more than what they're paying me on a subscription. So the pure subscription play can work really well in certain industries. I think it works great for just pure trademark attorneys too. You know, so many trademarks or checks or dispute letters or unlimited cease and desist letters or something, like, because that's kind of where it started, at least in the US, where it really took off. So like pure subscription can work. But a lot of my revenue is flat fee after they're subscribed, because I do the Costco model, right? Like once you're subscribed, and you're a member or a subscriber, now you get access to all the other suite of services, right? And there's no discount pricing because like you get access to those prices by being a subscriber. So I'm not like comparing this or that on my website, but I've seen some lawyers do that. The food law firm comes to mind, Jason Foscolo, even though he's not really doing that anymore, he still shows that comparative pricing on his website. I don't really do value pricing in the way of maximizing, you know, that value, that price that I could charge, because I'm intentionally serving the latent legal market. So I'm not trying to maximize what I'm charging, which is totally talk about not following it by the book, Matt, right? Like I am not following by the book at all because there's massive market opportunity. And if I could automate and take out the human stuff, like if I could send a link where the client fills out all the information and populates the document, and from time to time I update the document as laws, you know, change. I mean, like how much time am I actually spending doing that stuff, right? So those flat fees that I'm charging, you know, that's a lot of my revenue. I mean, that's probably a little bit more than 50% of my revenue. And that's not subscription revenue, right? So like, I feel like I'm still, like I'm in a similar boat as you then. If you're, like, are you using a similar model? Like where do your subscriptions come into play?
When I went solo, I pivoted from mostly litigation to a transactional only practice. I did not have a database of documents to automate. That's why a business and employment legal document database and automation tool like 650 is super useful. I can rely on the quality of the documents in 650's database since they're putting excellent legal minds to work curating and updating their documents and automations over time. When you're not billing by the hour, outsourcing and efficiency matters, and 650 can help you scale your practice to get high quality documents documents drafted in less time. Use the code LAWSUBSCRIBED at 650.com and when being onboarded to get 10% off. If you're not a business and employment attorney or you have your own documents that you'd prefer to use, then my next sponsor, Gavel, is the automation tool for you. Gavel allows you to build shareable, client-facing workflow and document automations. In other words, Gavel helps you create a legal practice where attorneys can monetize the value they bring clients in productized form and scale via subscriptions and flat fees. Use the code LAWSUBSCRIBED at Gavel.io to get 10% off an annual subscription. There's no one right way to automate and scale your practice, but with one or both of my sponsors, 650 and Gavel, you can take your subscription law firm to the next level. Links to both in the show notes. Now back to the show.
Yeah, so great question. And I think the one other thing that came to mind as you were talking there was that from our perspective, we try to remain self-aware that the only really valuable thing that we're building is the subscription part of our business. So even though it might be nominal in terms of revenue at the moment, if we decide tomorrow that we're checking out of the game, that's the only thing that will be worth anything to a third party. In terms of our subscription, we're Snap, exactly the same as you in terms of our call offering. So we specialize in estate planning. In order to get to the productization part of that piece of our business, you've got to be a subscriber. And we offer different service levels on that. We're moving to a model, and we've started it on the financial year in all starts on the 1st of July. So we started that in the last couple of months as we record here, whereby we then offer for those subscribers, they can then subscribe to the online products, but that will all be tailored. We'll do that on a value costing basis, which we realize is additional heavy lifting. But from our perspective, we just feel as though it's not appropriate to just completely say, well, value pricing is useless. We think that the disciplines and principles that create much better value for us and gets us much more aligned to what the customer actually wants. And to go to your point, it actually depends on the value as well. So that's one piece of our puzzle. Another piece is that because since 2020, we've lost a technology partner, but want to stay in that space, we've gone and spent a significant, a material amount of money rebuilding an automation platform using Hot Documents as the base, but then building on top of that across a number of different platforms. We offer that as a subscription service on a white label basis to other law firms. Mm-hmm. So there's a number of law firms around Australia where they basically just get to plug into our platform and they just pay us on a subscription basis for that. Again, we offer that. We develop the pricing for that on a firm-by-firm basis. So we apply value pricing principles, but then we roll it out as a subscription. And then between those two core offerings, we've then just got a whole lot of other offerings that we're, products probably exactly like you, that we're just constantly developing and evolving. Most recent release would be in the estate planning space. And I've heard you talk about this in other episodes, we view estate planning, if we do it properly, like part of our value proposition is you do it once, do it properly, you shouldn't need a lawyer again anytime soon. So what we offer off the back of that is that we then offer an annual health check on a subscription basis. And counterintuitively, we just stole this directly off the medical industry, but counterintuitively, the whole idea of that is that you actually want, when you come back to us next year and get checked, you want us to tell you, you don't need to do anything. And you actually pay for us to tell you, you're totally fine and you'll see value with that. So that was very counterintuitive for us. Because we're sort of still in this time billing model of going, oh, well, unless we change their trustee of their will, or unless we add in an asset, or unless we add in the name of the new kid, we've not actually, air quotes, done anything. Mm-hmm. So therefore, we can't charge anything. And the health industry really helped us to see that was wrong.
Yeah. I mean, that is a huge light bulb moment, right? Like, that's the clip that I put on social media. But seriously, because that is, like, there is value that you're giving to your client by telling them everything's good. Right? That's incredibly valuable. Like I'll give you an analogy for something I do in real life. And I've talked about this before, but this is one of the value adds that my plumber company, my HVAC company, they do. I pay them $9 a month, $9 a month. And included in that is a 10% discount on services and one annual free plumbing inspection. I mean, it's not free. I'm paying $9 a month for it, right?
Yeah. The position. Yeah.
And so the guy comes in and he's like, everything's good. Here are some recommendations that if you're interested and to avoid potential future bigger mistakes, that we can do this, this, and this, but they're not urgent. That's worth $9 a month for me, let alone the 10% discount I'm getting on the other services, right? So, I mean, I'm happily paying that, and they don't even offer an annual payment and discount because they want me to see that $9 a month coming in every month. So then I'm like, oh yeah, do I have an electrical thing that I need fixed? Because they know that their one offering, one, at least for me, you know, for some other people, they care about the 10% more. They care about the other things. But for me, just that 1 year annual free, you know, included plumbing inspection, that's worth it for me.
Yeah, that's a great analogy. Love it.
Yeah. And yeah. And so like, you know, I've gotten clients who they want me to review like an NDA or something. And it's like, no, this is like a really fair NDA. Or in a future where like bond terms or one NDA or these open source legal documents are becoming more and more of a thing. What's another one? Common Paper comes to mind as one of these other open source legal document platforms. Well, you know, like the lawyer comes in, make sure that the title, the names of the parties are correct. And then there's that one line, at least on bond terms, where it's like, okay, we could add in some variations from like the form NDA. And that's valuable. I mean, there's something there to that, right? So, but saying like, everything looks good, this is a mutual, very fairly worded non-disclosure agreement, that's valuable to the client. And I can't, if I'm billing time, I'm not making as much money on that as if I come in and edit, you know, a million things in that NDA because I'm incentivized to do so.
It's a perfect example from my perspective because I think it goes to the heart of why the subscription model can be so powerful in building trust. Mm-hmm. Because you see, if you compare it to a time billing model, it's the exact opposite. You're only rewarded by making it hard, making it complex, and that forever is jeopardizing the ability to build that trusted relationship with the underlying customer.
Are you, other than the like annual health check that you're offering as part of the subscription, do you do anything else to like incentivize your clients to stay subscribed? Things like annual newsletters, things like, you know, locked in at that pricing in case we ever raise our pricing. Like there's all these different strategies. I'm just curious to know if you're implementing any of them or testing any of them out.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's been a great advantage to keeping a lot of the principles from value pricing in there. So the core offering is just basically a health check. And then tiering up from there, you can be in higher offerings that offer, for example, the newsletter. They offer a whole range of additional solutions. It takes a lot of effort, obviously, to think, well, this is our core offering. And then we like to have somewhere between 9 and 15 additional service line items on the core offering. Well, that's a lot of heavy lifting to try to genuinely, you can't just make it a glib offering. You've got to actually genuinely offer something of value to justify, because our base price, don't quote me on this, but I think our base price for the annual health check is something like $99 a year, whereas in the top price, it's more like $500 a year. So if you're going to go up fivefold through your tiers, well, you've got to be able to demonstrate more than fivefold in terms of the value equation. So it's a challenge, but we feel as though we've got it to a level that's resonating and helping lock it in. Yeah.
And that's another really important insight that may be intuitive to you and I after learning everything we can about this model, but it's not intuitive to everyone. And that is that when you have higher tiered subscriptions, you're not just trying to, and it's 5 times more, you're not just 5xing the value, you're 10xing the value. Like you've got to take it way further than what it would be if it was just like a, you know, exact measurement. And that's hard, you know, that's 1 + 1 = 3. And, you know, it's hard to get your head around that.
Yeah. And it goes to the entire heart of everything that you talk about in that technology has to be the enabler there. Because if you thought about it through a time billing world, what you do is say, well, in the base package, I'll give you 20 minutes. In the middle package, I'll give you 1 hour. In the top package, I'll give you unlimited hours. Well, no. None of it can relate to human involvement or the amount of time they spend. All of it has to be enabled and be able to be scalable to get you to that value equation.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, looking even at like what that price would be like US, I think those prices are pretty reasonable. Like I know, like I have a $99 a year package, or I have a $99 a month package. My $20 a month is kind of like close, you know, it's a couple hundred a year. But now they're getting more than just an annual checkup with that. But I feel like those prices, what you're charging, are extremely reasonable. And I could think of clients or people who I know who would happily pay $500 a year for, you know, an annual checkup plus other services. So I feel like there's huge market opportunity with those prices. So that comes down to my next question I've been asking more and more of recent guests, which is, how the heck do you market this thing? Like, how do you tell people about it? How do you get the clients in the first place? Because I think the price is right. I think the price is reasonable, assuming, you know, the tiers make sense. But from 99 scale to 500, if that price works for somebody, why do they know that that's the right product for them? What are you doing to market? What are you doing to get clients? How is all that working?
I mean, you called out the VeriSage community, which has just been, there's the Ron Bakers and the Paul Duns and the Ben Eds on the Solid Enterprise and John Chisholm. But there's another guy called Tim Williams out of the US who really has helped mentor our business on that space. And his, I don't want to oversimplify his literature and thinking, but basically the way, what we take out of it is that to maintain margins, to maintain profitability, you have to be specialized, and you have to specialize within the specialization within the specialization. What does that mean in terms of answering your question? Our model is deliberate in that we don't actually have any customers. Now, hopefully that stops all of your listeners in their tracks saying, well, hang on a second, what are you talking about? I'm going to be a lawyer. There's a qualification to that. But all of our customers are only accessed through what we refer to as distribution channels. So people go to our website, they'll look at, there's a lot of firewalls. Basically, our website is nothing more than a landing page, and it basically forces people to go down other channels in order to get access to us. And that's quite a deliberate strategy because we only want pre-qualified leads that come to us, and those leads come from other professional advisors. So increasingly other law firms that don't specialize to the level we do, accounting firms and financial planners, they are treated for our business model, our marketing, they're treated as our customers. And that gives us great scale as well, because we might say, and I'm making this up, we might have, say, 200 professional firms that we have an okay relationship with, but they each have 2,000 clients. So as long as we can secure those firms and be a trusted advisor and someone that they want to go to, then we then get access to X percent of their customer base. So it means on a number of levels, their marketing has to be a little bit different to what might otherwise be the case if you're going straight to retail.
I think that paints a good picture and shows another avenue, right? Because and you can't, I have such a hard time, having been a philosophy major and studied Kant, where his categorical imperative, where it's like, I'm simplifying it here, right? But however you live or the choices you make, you are imposing on all other people that they should make the same choices and do the same things that you do. But you can't have a healthy market if we're all doing what you're doing. Because I'm also doing the opposite, where I'm miles wide and inches deep for the services I'm providing. And by doing that, if I can get my clients on the front end of a legal issue, I help them avoid that legal issue altogether. But if I can't, or they come to me too late, or they're subscribed to me for another reason and something else comes up, I need lawyers like you, where there's an estate planning thing. And of course, you're in a different, totally different jurisdiction, so we wouldn't make good referral partners. You never know. But like when I do simple estate plans for clients. And when somebody has a much more complicated estate planning need than what I'm able to provide, I need the specialists. And I need them in my networking and in my market and in my jurisdiction. And I want them to be subscription attorneys or flat fee based attorneys, because my clients hire me because they're price sensitive. So I want those specialists, right? So I guess what the takeaway is, you got to find which one works for you and pursue that type of market strategy.
Oh, I think that's a great summary. And I think from our perspective, part of the journey has been understanding that ultra specialization can be democratized by technology. Mm-hmm. And that's the piece that I love to use the word hybrid model. So we use value pricing and brain surgery at that higher end. We're fully aware that the democratization of that is happening by technology, whether we like it or not. Mm-hmm. So if we're going to be cannibalized, we prefer to do it ourselves. And that's where the subscription model is building for us, because we're taking stuff that we've learned through the brain surgery, enabling it through technology, and then getting it out through a wider distribution channel.
So Matthew, you've mentioned technology a lot. How about, to the extent you're willing and able to, what are some of the technology solutions that you're using? If any of them are off the shelf, otherwise if they're custom solutions, I guess poo-poo for the rest of us that we can't get access to them, unless we can, where it makes sense.
Yeah. Well, we have it. Global domination is next on next week's to-do list. We haven't quite sorted out global domination this week. But so certainly any of your Aussie listeners, more than happy to talk for them about getting access to our customized building. One thing I would say is, unless you've got money to burn and you really love it, I think customization is like a stupid thing we've done. But we're in a hole now. So we've got to try to make the best of it. So that, as I said, the customization for our core solutions has been through a number of different technology providers, but then always try to use a base underlying technology. So I think I might have touched on, we use HotDocs for a lot of our base automation. We're increasingly looking at, and I know you've profiled them in other sessions, their documents, and we're probably getting more and more attached to them. I think we were one of the first handful of subscribers to that when they launched that product. So we've really enjoyed growing with them. We're very small, very, very, very small, even in the Australian market, but it's been good to see the way they've developed. We've been on Zendesk for a lot of our internal intellectual property management, if you like. So it's a long time in ticketing, and that has been really good. But probably because we've put so much content in that, we're probably just trying to explore exactly what that looks like in a post-AI world as to exactly what that might become. Because at the moment, really only it's that internally, and we don't expose a lot of that externally. But one of the other products that we've built in recent times is basically closed communities that offer ongoing education on a subscription basis to professional advisors. So that a lot of, we would have, we've written over 20 textbooks. We've probably got 3 or 4 million words of published content in that environment. And one of the questions which we're going to ask ourselves is, well, how can we use technology to make that more useful to subscribers on a much smaller basis, if you like? Like, people don't enjoy reading 150,000 word textbook. They prefer to just get the bite size, and what can we do to, and Zendesk might be part of a pathway on that. And then everything else, I think, when I was jotting it down to pretty standard, so I've just been on Dropbox for years, Calendly, Teams, Zoom, may not have heard of some of these. So yeah, we've tried to stay mainstream where we can. It's also been quite hard because we went to the cloud in 2014. We didn't realize the global pandemic was coming. And so even like whether it's Net Documents or Action Step, Zoom didn't exist, I think, back then. We were still on, what was it, GoTo Webinar or something.
Yeah.
The technology has just moved that quickly over the last 6 or 7 years.
Yeah. Yeah. And we haven't really talked about metaverse on this podcast, but at some point in VR or augmented reality, you're going to be wearing glasses or contacts and your client will be sitting right, they'll be right in front of you, right? Or Apple Vision Pro, right?
Yeah. It's coming. Absolutely coming.
Yeah. I would love to be able to rationalize expensing buying an Apple Vision Pro. I just can't bring myself to do it. No clients will meet me there. So.
Surely the tax man's a little bit more generous than that. It's a Charlie Munger quote, but the technology you haven't paid, probably technology you don't buy, you've already paid for.
Yeah.
Put your name on the waiting list.
Right. I want to ask you, just one quick thread I want to pull there is on the NetDocs, because I did have After Patterns co-founder on my podcast, and Pattern Builder was, of course, acquired by...
It was a great show.
Yeah. So what have you been using Pattern Builder at all within NetDocs?
We had, I think, a couple of team members in Sydney about 10 days ago with their soft launch of that into Oz. Mm-hmm. So the answer is not yet, but we're right there, and we want to be within the first few people that they go live with on that.
Because I know they've been promoting that they're really incorporating some generative AI features into that Pattern Builder thing. So now you can, using generative AI, like interface, create things in Pattern Builder is what I've, at least the public material that NetDocs is putting out there. I mean, I'm priced out of NetDocs because I'm so small and I'm charging so little for the LinkedIn market that I've talked to them to try to get true solo pricing, and they have certain seats and certain other requirements. I'm Google Workspace. I'm not Microsoft. So, it doesn't work for my firm. I so want to get access to Pattern Builder, but they put it behind their paywall of you got to join NetDocs first. But I've looked into it and it looks incredibly powerful. I mean, and Gavel is kind of like the open source, like the non-behind a paywall solution, which is why I'm glad they're a sponsor. And they recently did a similar thing with generative AI where like tell it what you want to automate and it'll automate it for you. I think they do different things ultimately, but like it's a similar sort of a end goal of like automating your practice, right? Are you which makes me so, you know, you're just getting your feet wet with Pattern Builder. But any like other generative AI solutions that you've been looking into, whether it's, you know, GPT-4 and building your own GPT now, which is really something, or any of those things you or any of your team members are working on?
Well, I had a couple of responses there. I think it's a bit disappointing that they don't, I guess they've got to build their business model how they want to build it, but it is disappointing that they don't have the solopreneur solution for you there. So I'll give you two answers on Pattern Builder. It's terrible. You're not missing anything at all. It's a joke. It's a complete rubbish. So that's the answer to try to make it feel better. The actual answer is it's mind blowing. And we actually, so we with our external/internal tech builder, they were trying to get us to go down the ChatGPT stuff, but we've actually just abandoned that. And that's as recent in the last 3 months, because the Pattern Builder just looks so good. It's, I don't want to talk it up too much, but it just looks so good for what we need to do that we've, and we're not a big firm, but we've moved all resources that we're otherwise looking at that bespoke build through ChatGPT, and we're just doubling down on Pattern Builder. That's what we're going to do.
Yeah. I mean, it's for the legal industry, you know,
correct,
as opposed to ChatGPT, which is just this broad, you know, trained on all of the internet. Well, yeah, that's nice for like a foundational model, but for like focused on a profession, I think we're going to see more and more of these narrower models on top of foundational models that are trained in specific areas.
Yeah. And because we've been on there basically from the first day they launched in Oz anyway, like everything's there. And we've been so disciplined about our content centralization. Yeah, millions and millions of words of settled content in our areas of specialization that I don't want to talk it up too much because we haven't actually built anything yet, but it's looking unbelievably cool.
I've started to interview, to have people back for a second time. So in 6 months' time, Matthew, we'll see where you're at with Pattern Builder, because I think it's...
No pressure.
Though that type of technology, I mean, I talked about this with Toma Officer, right? Like, it doesn't incentivize billing time when you're using that tool, right? It just doesn't...
It's extraordinary, that's it. Like, I cannot comprehend so I wasn't in the room, okay? So this is words vicariously, but I think it's true. So they've walked them through, this is at the Pattern Builder conference, one day full conference, all the heavy hitting people there. And then they're at Q&A at the end. And someone said, oh, but how are we going to charge for all of this? Like, what will our hourly rates need to go to in order to keep that profitability? What to say? But you can sort of see the room was divided. Apparently the room is divided into the people going, like, seriously, you haven't worked this out yet? Apparently the person on the panel was very polite and they said, oh, well, there's these ideas like subscription and value pricing that you could perhaps look into. But then someone else said, oh, well, no, because you can't trust the computers. So you'll need to spend even longer checking all the stuff that they do. So you won't need to change the hourly rates at all. A person convinced against their will remains of the same opinion, I think is the quote.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. Like, we will, like, I check the work, right? But if you're following me on LinkedIn, you'll see that I was commenting on a Carolyn Elephant post recently, and she had this generative AI image that she generated to talk about how generative AI is transforming. It's creating AI forward law firms. And what do they look like? But there was a spelling error in the text in the image, but she generated it with AI. And no matter how much she'd reprompt Dolly, it wouldn't correct the error. Did you see this? So much for AI forward law firms if the AI can't get it right. And I said, in response to that, I said, well, if your business is graphic design and you were to draw that image from scratch, maybe it takes you, you know, digitally draw it from scratch, maybe it takes you 1 or 2 hours to draw that image from scratch. It was highly detailed.
Yeah.
It's perfect though. No spelling errors, right? With generative AI generates that image in seconds. And now in minutes, you go in and correct the spelling error. So what used to take 2 hours now takes minutes. You don't want to be billing time. You want to be charging for value or offering that product on a recurring basis on subscription, right? And so that's where the subscription model, and, you know, it comes back in. By the time this episode airs, probably it'll be around the time I'm giving a presentation at ABA Tech Show. So I'll give a sneak peek to you right now, Matthew, of one of the things I talk about in there. And that is, if you charge $500 an hour, 10 hours of billable time is $5,000, right? Now, generative artificial intelligence and AI is going to take those 10 hours and it's only going to take you 10 minutes. Anecdotally, that's what attorneys are saying. In order to get $5,000 for only billing for 0.2, what are you going to need to charge? If you're charging $500 an hour, you're going to need to 50x your rate, right? So that means you have to charge $25,000 an hour to make 0.2 worth $5,000 for you. What client will want to pay $25,000 an hour, even if they get the result a lot faster and it's the same amount of money? No client is going to want to pay for that, don't you think?
I love it. A bit more positively, which again gets to the heart of everything you speak about, is that you can be making $25,000 an hour if you scale and if you use subscription to get yourself there.
Absolutely. I'd even decouple it completely from time, you know, but yes, yeah. You can be sitting there and in 2 minutes be making $5,000 if you productize and scale. I mean, without question, right?
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. Well, I mean, with that, I mean, we're at time, so I feel like we could keep talking for hours, but I have to ask you the question I ask all my guests, Matthew, which is, of course, is a hot dog a sandwich and why?
Now, so luckily I've researched this and the answer is 42. Did I get that right?
I think you technically did get that right, but for the sake of I want to compare. I have an upcoming compilation episode of all the answers. I am curious to know. And of course, you're in a totally different country. So your answer, you know, it's okay if it's out of left field. I am curious to know. What do you think? Hot dog, sandwich? Why? Why not?
Way above my pay grade. So I asked the next thing to Google or ChatGPT, which is my kid. And she said, no, it's a hot dog.
Is that better? Ask the kids.
Yeah.
They have a lot less baggage with the way that they think.
Correct.
Very correct. That's great. We'll take it. Answer accepted. Matthew, if people wanted to get in touch, what's the best way for them to do that?
Must be something to do with the name. I'm a little bit like you. LinkedIn is probably the only space there that I spend any time on. So yeah, happy to answer any questions or help as people see valuable.
And of course, link in the show notes, but viewlegal.com.au for
AU. You know. Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much, Betsy. Love what you're doing and all power to you.
Thank you. And that's our show. Thanks again to 650 and Gavel for being sponsors. The best way for others to discover this show is for you to share it with somebody you think would find value from it. Follow me on LinkedIn, since that's where I'm most active on social media, and click the bell towards the top right of my profile to get notified about all of my posts about this podcast and everything else I think is valuable for you to see. To get in touch, message me on LinkedIn or email kurbis@lawsubscribed.com. All links are in the show notes. Until next time, this is Matthew Kurbis with Law Subscribed.